Heaven sends a song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly Signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand online at weeklysignals.com or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals, Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org, and these days we are podcasting. What you need to do is go to penonfire.com, click on the radio tower, which will bring you to the radio page, and you will receive directions for how to reach the podcasts. There's 80-some shows up there. And this one should be up next week. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Oh, today my guest is Janet Fitch. She's back, and she's here to talk about her second novel, Painted Black. Her first novel, White Oleander, was a bestseller in an Oprah's Book Club selection. It's been translated into 24 languages. Was made into a feature film. Janet is a native of L.A. She teaches fiction writing in the Master of Professional Writing program at the University of Southern California. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on again.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Let's talk about Painted Black, and talk a little bit about what moved you to write this story. It's a story, again, ultimately dealing, well, between a young woman and an older woman. And White Oleander was the same. They have different relationship and all that. But it's interesting how most writers aren't thinking theme. It's a theme only resides in the mind of readers often. And I don't know if you were thinking theme when you started this book or how it came about.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I saw it as a three-way love story, a love triangle, really, between two women and a young man, the boyfriend of one, the son of the other. It came about, it had been a short story, a kind of a gothic little story, that I always thought there was something more to be said that was embodied in the story. And between White Oleander and Painted Black, I had a story, a book that hadn't come together. And it was a very difficult time for me, and I would look back and through my short stories to try to find something that would rekindle some confidence or hope for the future. And I came upon this story. It's the story of an art model in 1980 Los Angeles who falls in love with a young man who sees something more in her than just a shape in space, you know, kind of opens the world for her. But he is a suicide. He kills himself. And leaving her having to decide, did he take that world with him, the world that he showed her? Did he take it with him when he went, or does she get to have it? And complicating her grief is interactions with his mother, who blames her for the death of the son. But they're attracted to each other as well because they both knew him. And I just really liked the intense three-person drama of it. I was kind of a Bergman addict when I was a young person, and his influence always stayed with me.
Well, how much did you know about the story before you began? Are you an outliner and a plotter?
No, I never know where I'm going. With this story, I just knew the heart of it. I knew that there was this odd three-way dynamic between these two women and the missing third corner of the love affair. I mean, he's very present in the story. And after having made an enormous mess with the book that didn't come together, I thought, you know, something small and intense would be the perfect antidote.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book that didn't come together, because it seems like, at least what I've read, that there was a piece in, I think, The Times some time ago a month or so ago that it was all ready to be published, and you were the one who pulled back and said no.
Oh, no, it was not ready to be published. The publisher thought it was ready to be published.
That's what I mean, that you could have had it out there, but you...
But it was in no way ready for anything but the deep bottom drawer of my file cabinet. Yeah, so it was, that was difficult, you know, because I thought that I knew what I was doing, you know. So you have a big book, and then you think, well, how do I top that? And that's no way to create art, is how do I top that? You know, you have to go with what really taps into who you are and kind of your creative wellspring. So I really, in this book, I really went back to where my creative wellsprings are.
What do you make of that, though, that the publisher was, you know, willing and able to put it out there? And
well,
you felt it wasn't ready?
It.
Pardon me?
He hadn't seen it. you know, I think once he saw it, he was aware that what I was working on, this book, was a far better approach.
Mm-hmm. So, and then you said this story, Painted Black, began with a short story.
Yeah.
Talk about that. Is that, because didn't White Oleander begin as a short story?
Yeah, it did. White Oleander began, the first three chapters of the novel are an expansion of the short story. In this case, I took a look at it the other day, the short story that I had used as sort of my springboard to this novel. And I realized that the entire novel is like latent in that little short story. It's really, rather than the opening, it's really the heart of the story, that the heart of the novel is there in the short story, the kind of its spring, you know, sort of gothic trance in which this girl tries to replace a woman's dead son in sort of a vacuum in her family. It's very persona.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something I hear from new writers a lot, and they don't know whether to begin with a novel or a short story. And it seems that short stories pretty much are always the way you begin.
Yeah.
And they can develop into novels or not. But
yeah, for me, I always suggest that people work on short stories. And then when they get a hold of the, you know, it's like just getting the tail of the tiger. You know, when you get a short story that you tell the story as well as you can and there's still more, there's just more there, then you know. But it's like marrying before you've dated.
Mm-hmm.
It's better to date, you know, and go through some stories. And, you know, some don't go anywhere. Most don't go anywhere, you know, except they're fine for the length they are. But every once in a while, there's one that just has more energy to it, more to say.
If you just tune in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Janet Fitch. Her new novel is Painted Black, and it's published by Little Brown. Now, you had a successful first novel. You have a successful second novel. Sometimes people are under the impression that successful novelists have never really had to deal with rejection. And I know you have in the early days.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've been a failure a lot longer than I've been a success. I wrote for 10 years before I sold my first short story.
10 years.
People said, oh, send to the places that you read.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sending to, like, the New Yorker and the Atlantic. I had no idea. You know, send to the places that were publishing stories like the ones you're writing.
Yeah.
And start reading those journals. And, you know, so you work your way up. You know, you don't have... you have neither grandiosity nor you know, stifling humility about your work, but you develop an accurate assessment of where you're coming from and accept that you don't start out brilliant. You start out terrible. And then you learn as you go along. You know, I mean, some people, I guess, are brilliant at the get-go. But most, like for me, I decided I was going to be a writer before I'd ever written a word.
Hmm.
Just to sort of clear the space for it, you know, to declare my intention. And then I had to learn to write. So when I sold, I remember selling, when I sold my first book, I had a party. And I put all my rejections on the walls of my living room, and they reach from the baseboard to over my head on all four walls of the room. So rejection is so much a part of it, because that's the concrete evidence that you are putting your stuff out there, and you're open to criticism, and you're willing to not just to produce work, but you're willing to test and find out, you know, whether you're making it yet.
Yeah. So then 10 years of rejections, and what kept you going in during that time?
Well, at some point I had to, you know, I asked myself, man, you could work your whole life and never, ever sell anything. You know, what happens then? Should I quit? But I realized that I get a lot out of writing. I don't know really what I think about the big issues of life. You know, what do I think about the human condition? What are my own obsessions? I don't really know until I write about them. So I had to decide, do I quit? Do I keep writing? And I decided that as a free human being, I could do what I wanted with my life, including writing short stories that never sold. That was my privilege as a human being, to spend my life the way I wanted to, so that on my deathbed I could say, I lived my life the way I wanted to.
Mm.
I did what I wanted to with my time on Earth. And so I kept writing, and in fact, I stopped pushing so hard for publication. I started spending more time worrying about the quality of the writing itself and learning, you know, just I kept pushing the craft, and then I started getting published.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and your first novel actually was not White Oleander, but a young adult novel, I believe.
Yeah, I had the privilege of a test run. You know, I had a young adult novel that to say it didn't sell well is an understatement. Every once in a while at a signing or somewhere, there'll be a collector who will bring a copy of this book in. And I just am always so startled to see it. But it didn't sell well. It, you know, didn't really break the surface of, you know, anybody's consciousness. And young adult had not really been what I'd been planning to do. That was from a short story that my agent, God love him, who sat with me for 12 years before I had something really for him to represent. He suggested that the story would make a good young adult. So I gave it a try, as you know, and I still like that book, but it was not my intention to write young adult.
And so, as I remember from when you were on last time for White Oleander, when your agent sent that out, you expected it to take as long to sell and as your first novel.
Oh, well, I had had a novel before that is also in the deep recesses of the bottom drawer of the file cabinet, which had made the rounds for 2 years and never sold. The young adult, it took 4 years for it to sell. So I figured that was about what I was looking at, 4 years for sale. So White Oleander, I'd been to a writer's conference up in the Sierras called the Squaw Valley Writers Conference. And I met an editor there who I really liked. And I thought, if I ever have a novel, this is the person I'm sending it to. So when I wrote White Oleander, I told my agent to send it to him first. And he's the one, and he bought it. So kind of like, wow. That, it was very exciting. It was also difficult because I was starting a second novel in the middle of a, you know, whirlwind, unexpected whirlwind of attention for that book. Whereas I'm hoping, you know, so the second novel, I thought I was going to do this for the rest of my life, that I was going to be like caught in some Groundhog Day, you know, karmic cycle where I would wake up for the rest of my life and have to write a second novel. So now I must say, I will never have to write a second novel again. That's quite a relief, you know, going into the third novel. I'll just write one.
Well, it seems that it must be a ton of pressure to have such a successful first novel, and then what? I mean, it's almost like, well, I don't know how you must feel pressured to do better or to top this.
Yeah. Do something bigger, more difficult, you know.
How does that affect your writing? How does that sort of...
It affects it in a very negative way. It's certainly, you know, what happens is you try to top it, you make an enormous mess, you can't tell anybody, you feel like a total failure, you become incredibly depressed, you think you can never write again. And then at that point, that's where, you know, either you get out, you find a way out of that, or you don't. You know, either you get another novel or you just can't get out of that, you know, having your confidence so thoroughly shaken that you just don't. You know, what I did is I found something I thought I could do, you know, a very small three-person book. And, you know, it didn't turn out to be that small a book because as I was writing it, you know, you remember, oh, there's a whole universe inside a person, you know. But at least it kept it from scaring me to death by spreading out all over the globe. But yeah, I put a great deal of pressure on myself anyway. So the added pressure, where if you fail, it's one thing to fail when nobody's going to see you and you're used to failing, and that's just, you know, kind of, you have all kinds of mechanisms to deal with that. But when you, the idea of failing in front of, when the people going to see you do it, you know, it's like falling down the ice skating rink in front of the hockey team, you know. Everybody's going to see your underwear, you know. That's, you know, it's additional pressure that it makes it just that much harder. Because writing is all about suppressing anxiety anyway. And to get a big double scoop of it on top of that, you know, makes it quite difficult.
Say a little more about that. That's interesting.
Anxiety is the water in which writers swim because we don't know what the story is going to be. We don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it is really pulling a rabbit out of a hat, and you've worn the hat, you know, and the hat barely exists, you know, and then you're supposed to pull living things out of it. And you know, at least I know from experience that there are things in that hat if you're, you know, patient and you pull them out one by one. But it is frightening. It's frightening all the way through. You don't know whether it's any good. You don't know, you know, you've got hold of something, but you don't know where it's going to go. Sometimes it leads you right up a blind alley and you have to pull it out and start again. You know, and then you're always asking, who's going to care about this? There's nothing but anxiety. So it's like really, really just keeping a lid on it, always. And, you know, I think that a lot of the people who... I've been in workshops with wonderful writers, you know, people, you know, just as good as anything you'd see out in the marketplace. But... it's too stressful to do that kind of work. It really takes somebody who's just doggedly determined that no matter what, they're going to do it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yes, you just have to. I think that's that really sort of separates the writers who persevere, who do it, who will are willing to persevere no matter what through it all.
Right.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be back with Jan Fitch, who will also read to us. So don't go anywhere. Stay right here.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
The Sharp Show. Featuring irreverent debates about politics, religion, and popular culture. Unscripted, with Sharp's off-the-cuff remarks occasionally provoking anger. Monday mornings, 8 to 9 a.m.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI-FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from UC Irvine, and we're on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We've been here since 5 o'clock Pacific time with Janet Fitch, whose new book is Painted Black. Let's bring her back on. Hi there.
Hi.
I'm struck with something you said earlier, and that is that you have... Well, at least two novels, finished novels in the drawer, buried deep. And, you know, most writers are anxious to get their work out there. So they write a novel, maybe revise it a few times, and then start sending it out with a certain anxiety, speaking of anxiety, mm-hmm. To have it out there, to have an agent take it on and maybe help them a bit with some revising before they send it out, but but there's such an anxiety to get the work out there, and it's not always ready, and writers are not always in touch with that, when it is ready and when it's not ready. But you seem so willing to just keep your work to yourself until it's absolutely ready.
Yeah, because you don't get a second chance. You know, it's like coming down to a first, you know, to answer the door for a first date in curlers and, you know, a ratty bathrobe. You know, that image is never dispelled. You know, you can't say, oh, come in, I'll be down in a few minutes. You know, you want to present your best work because you don't want to, you know, you want to preclude as much of that rejection as you can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that even if a publisher rejects a book, that it will have been close. It will have been a fight in the editorial meeting. And they'll remember you even if they had to turn the book down. And it's all about how much, you know, how much care you take in, you know, not just the craft of storytelling, but also in the music of the sentences themselves.
Do you read your work aloud to yourself?
I do. And I love the sound of music, language. I read poetry aloud. I love to be read to. I'm an addict for books on tape. I just love the sound of language.
I imagine, well, maybe not, but I'll say it anyway. I imagine that people have said to you, why don't you bring out those two novels that are buried?
Ew. I have more than that. Well, in the first case, you have to learn to write. You don't necessarily want that, you know, out there representing yourself. You know, there's a reason why it didn't get published. You know, I feel it as a physical kind of sick feeling when something isn't right. You know, I wouldn't ever show it to other, you know, maybe I'd show it to a few trusted writer friends who know what it's like to be in the trenches, but I would never show it to the outside world. It makes me kind of ill. And even in the work, you know, a book that I'm working on, if there's a part that I'm having trouble with, I'll experience it as nausea until I've solved the problem with it.
It's interesting. Will you read to us?
I will.
And if you just tuned in, again, I'm with Janet Fitch, and she's about to read from Paint It Black, published by Little Brown.
Yeah, well, this is section The First Christmas After Her Boyfriend, After Josie Tyrell's Boyfriend Has Committed Suicide. It takes place in 1980, punk rock Los Angeles in Echo Park. She didn't want a holly jolly. She didn't want a very merry or a Feliz Navidad. It was only 8 o'clock, and she had the whole night to get through. All over the city, people were sitting down to turkey dinners and trimming trees and schlogging eggnog till they puked. She threaded her raw, muffled Falcon up and down the hills and drops of Echo Park, of Silver Lake and Angelino Heights, drinking and avoiding the house behind the house on Lemoyne Street, where no one lived anymore, listening to a Germs tape on the tinny car stereo. She should have gone down to Fullerton with Penn and Shirley and Paul to the Black Flag show, but that scene was getting so ugly. Phil Baby invited her to a party at his place. It sounded like death on a TV tray, a bunch of art teachers in horn-rimmed glasses getting swacked on hot wine with cinnamon sticks. There was nowhere she wanted to be, nothing to do but get blasted and drive around until her gas ran out. She cruised Sunset, the family strolling along the broad sidewalks, the stores all decorated, windows spray-painted with snow and cartoon Santas, Feliz Navidad. She stopped at the Chinese market. The parking lot was jammed, people buying their last-minute fish and sponge cake. She pushed a cart around for a while, banging into people in the fluorescent light down the long, cold rows of vegetables and fruit. She decided to buy a weird, huge fruit that looked like a porcupine. It weighed about 20 pounds and smelled like armpits. Michael would do something like that. There was no trace of Holly Jolly, and here, God bless the Chinese, men with huge cleavers hacked up chickens and hunks of pork behind the butcher case without a shred of tinsel or a single Santa hat. Two tiny withered grandmas stood over a metal sink full of little blue crabs, scrambling over each other in a hopeless bid for escape. Maybe that was God, peering over the edge of the sink as you tried to claw your way out, picking off this one and that. She carried her purchases out to the car, some of the bean cake Michael liked, and the stinking porcupine fruit, and started driving again, the half pint of Vadi between her knees. The Pioneer Market lot still bristled with unsold Christmas trees. They'd bought their own tree here exactly 12 months ago. She pulled into the parking lot, parked sloppily, trying to see through tears that stung like bleach. They had been happy. They had been. She got out and pushed her way between the trees blindly, brushing their sticky needles with her hands, the smell overpowering, clinging to her arms. She wanted him desperately, fiercely. She wanted him back right now. She didn't think she could live one more moment. Miss, a pimply-faced box boy was peering at her through the branches. Miss, are you all right? Do I look all right to you? She said, clutching at pine branches, her hands smelling of pitch pine and loss. Do I look all right? She gave up and drove over to the Diazepam Bakery, which was doing quite a business tonight, Pan Dolce and Valium. She put some fresh pan dulce on the tray and wrapped a 20 in a couple of ones, and the small blank-faced Salvadoran put a little something extra in her bag. Mm-hmm. All along Sunset, telephone poles and boarded-up windows were pasted thick with advertisements for Club Bahia, Chicho Montoya y Gloria Nunez, Sabado Nueve de Diciembre, La Laguna Azul con Brooke Shields. A stoic young man in a hooded sweatshirt sold oranges at the corner of Alvarado. He would have to sell them all before he could go home, probably just a room hot-bedded with three other migrants in Pico Union. No better Navidad than hers. She rolled down her window and held out $2. He brought the sack over, a small corpse in his arms. She passed the money through and took the weight from him. She could smell it, saffron over sour green. It smelled better than the stink fruit in the back. She threw it onto the passenger seat and tore open the bag, peeled one on the steering wheel as she drove. The rind was thick, the orange smaller than it should have been, cold and sour. But she ate it anyway, knowing somewhere there was a place where the oranges would be allowed to ripen all the way. They would fall off the trees before they were picked. They were so ripe. The smell was only a promise. That's where they should have moved, somewhere things were allowed to ripen all the way.
Thank you so much. That was Janet Fitch reading from Painted Black. Listening to you and also reading this book, L.A. is so vivid and so detailed. I know you are just a master of detail anyway, but as you're writing about L.A., are you thinking, let me make this as vivid as I can? Or is it just the way you write, period, that you want details and more details?
I want a kind of, I think that we're kind of starved for sensual reality here at the beginning of the 21st century. You know, we have a lot of virtual experience, most of it visual. We work in denatured environments. We sit and look at screens a lot. We control our temperature and the sound we hear. And I think the human organism is created for a more complex set of impressions than that. I think we're hungry for it. So I try to involve all the senses. My books are very physical. My character, especially this character, she's an art model. She's quite a body person. So she really perceives things through all the senses. And L.A. for me is a favorite subject to write about because there is such a, it is so complex on the sensual level. And it's also something, hasn't been done to death. You know, there's still an L.A. to be created on the page that literature has not been as, it's not been as curious or specific as to the reality of this place. You know, in literature, L.A. is this like weird brew of it's Beverly Hills and a movie set and a freeway and a riot and Disneyland. You know, it's like, and that is no L.A. that I recognize, where people actually go to work, they take the bus, they do their laundry, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm eager to create an L.A. on the page that is recognizable as, you know, the L.A. that I see. And so I bring, you know, especially all the senses to the description.
Do you think in general that setting should be character? I mean, your setting in this book is another character, really.
Yeah, well, I think that we're outgrowths of the place and the history where, you know, that's created us. You know, Los Angeles, to me, is, I mean, it's a complex living organism, you know, and I know it's like all the, it's the textures of its different neighborhoods, and there's a feeling tone to each one of them. I see it as so alive, and it's almost as if the people are outgrowth of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like literature that is that way. You know, I like a lot of Western literature is certainly that way. I love Lawrence Durrell, you know, the Alexandria Quartet.
Yes, yes.
You know, his people are definitely outgrowths of Alexandria.
Interesting, yeah, yeah. So your details then, do they make it in the first draft, or are you constantly revising and you're getting down something and then adding, texturizing?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm constantly asking myself to see it more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a tree in a sentence on first pass, I'll go back and, you know, well, what tree? What is it? You know, what kind of shade does it cast? What do the leaves look like? Is there any wind or not? Just trying to see it more and more clearly so that the reader has a really vivid experience.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Janet Fitch, whose new book is Painted Black, published by Little Brown. I'm assuming this novel is not autobiographical, and yet Josie's pain at her boyfriend's suicide is so deep and gut-wrenching that I am just so curious where you draw from, where you drew that from.
Well, I don't know. I feel like if we work deeply enough,
mm-hmm.
we break through some floor of personal experience and break into collective experience, you know, that's down there below, you know, what we ourselves have experienced. You know, I think it's all there inside of us, the whole emotional piano, but we really have to be willing to go there. I mean, I've certainly been depressed, and I live with depressed people, and I know what it looks like, and suicide is an issue. Has been, you know, if you're depressed, there's like a dark shape at the bottom of the swimming pool, you know, and you try to swim away from that place as fast as you can, but there's a certain, you know, kind of deadly magnetism that it has if you're in a depressed state. And so I'm certainly aware of that. And, you know, I think suicide in general affects everyone, no matter how distant you are from somebody who has committed suicide. It always raises issues, no matter how distant. You think, you know, that guy that I saw at the bus was a suicide. It's like, God, you know, maybe I shouldn't have, you know, I should have given him my seat. Or, you know, no matter how distant, the closer you are to that person, the more those intense those feelings are. They take the basic grief process that everyone goes through with it, with the loss, and they intensify it because that person voluntarily checked out. And so the guilt, the anger, the suddenness of the loss, the feeling of rejection, I mean, it's all profoundly there. And I'm very interested in writing not about people who make big dramatic gestures, but the experience of most of us is being the ones having to deal with the aftermath.
Hmm.
So I'm much more interested in survivors of, you know, other people's big, messy actions, because I think that's more what more people have to deal with. I mean, it's like taking your... I mean, suicide is like taking your depression and giving it to everyone around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a totally diabolical thing to do.
Hmm.
Although when you're in that shape, you don't think of it that way.
Right.
You know, when you're in that kind of depression, you think, oh, I'm just this magnet of doom, and the best thing I can do is just check out, and that's the kindest thing I can do to the people around me. I mean, that's the head they're in. Whereas, in fact, it is the worst thing that anybody can do to the people around them, because it's just handing depression to everyone. You're multiplying it 100 times.
Yeah. Do you worry when you're writing that that people you know, that readers, whomever, will think that you are your characters?
No, I don't worry about it. You know, I mean, if people think that I am my characters, I've succeeded as a novelist.
Mm.
You know, I kind of see it as a compliment.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause that does seem to be something that hangs writers up, especially new writers, you know, where they're worried about who's looking over their shoulder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't. I think that if I'm kind of excited when people mistake what I've written for fact.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's thrill. It means that you've created a world so real that people think it's real,
mm.
You know, which is what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's too bad if they get upset with me and think that it's real and it's, you know, somehow it's about them or something, but I, you know, inwardly I'm always thrilled.
What are you reading right now?
I'm right in the middle of John Dospassos' Manhattan Transfer.
Uh-huh.
I've never read him, and it's funny because in the 20s he was like one of the three considered great American writers, Fitzgerald, Faulkner, and Dospassos. And people don't read him anymore. So I've been curious about him. And he's very modernistic. There are a lot of voices. He's very audio. You know, he hears all the voices in passing. And he's a world eater. I mean, he tries to put the whole world in it. It's very modern. It moves very quickly. Really enjoying it.
Interesting. Now, are you reading it or listening to it?
No, I'm reading it.
Yeah. What's the difference for you, reading a book or listening to a book?
Because
I know you said you love language.
I read when I can, and I listen to books on tape because I usually take them out of the library. I just, you know, then it's potluck. You
mm-hmm.
You see what's there, and you say, oh, I haven't read that. Whereas for me, the book I read on the page is more intentional. I go out to read that book.
Sure.
Where, you know, it's more serendipitous what I listen to. Often I tend to listen to the classics because I'll see them on the shelf at the library, and it's like, oh, you know, My Antonia, never
mm-hmm.
read that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I go to the bookstore, I intend to buy a certain book, and I'm looking for it. And sometimes I pick up a few others, but it's always intentional. So that's it. You know, I like to do both. I'm always doing both.
We are at the end of our time, and as always, I like to ask if you have any words of advice for the writers listening.
Any words of advice?
Yeah,
I gotta say, I guess I should say that the struggle that, newer writers are experiencing, they think that once they get published, you know, that's magically all that anxiety and struggle and stuff go away because you know you're acceptable suddenly, and it doesn't go away. It's always that's the condition of writing, and that there's no, it's not a sign of incapacity or failure. It's just the way it is. You know, it's the work of, if it was easy, everybody would do it.
Mm. Well, thanks so much for being here again.
And well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's been great talking to you.
Thanks.
That was Janet Fitch speaking to us from Los Angeles, and her new book is Painted Black, published by Little Brown. And this hour always flies by. You hear me moaning and groaning and sighing, and that's why I look at the clock above the door, and I think, another minute, another 5 minutes, another whatever. And I look at my paper here with all kinds of things I want to talk about, and never enough time. So in case you wonder why I'm sighing, that's why. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Carl Jung, who said, "If there is a fear of falling, the only safety consists in deliberately jumping." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. You can learn more at penonfire.com and go to the radio page and listen to some 80-some shows that have been podcasts and archived. I think Janet Fitch is on there from when she was on with White Oleander, and that was a wonderful interview as well. So take care, and I will talk at you next time.